Hello and welcome as we go bilingual for the first time on Hannes Land Allowes, and as we welcome James Hawes, the author of The Shortest History of Germany. This discussion feels particularly apt because I read The Shortest History of Germany during my time in quarantine. James used to live in Wales and still has family here, and although we're discussing The Shortest History of Germany for the most part, a book that did reach number 2 in the Sunday Times bestsellers list, he also has a lot to say about the future of the UK and the Union, what history means to him, and why I shouldn't try being Joan of Arc just yet, although you'll have to listen to the whole podcast to get the full context of that. You'll get to hear James discuss his thesis that throughout its long history, Germany has been a country that has always looked in two different directions, one towards the east and one towards the west, and despite the reunification, why that still exists in Germany today. Here goes. I hope you enjoy. Okay, that looks great. I can see the audio registering, so it looks fine. So welcome, James. Thank you for coming.
Good morning, man. It's a great pleasure to be here.
And when I say thank you for coming, obviously I mean thank you for being on this FaceTime call with me because of the current situation. So my first question would be, as I first looked at the book, how do you begin writing something that covers such an extensive time period?
Well, the sad truth there is, Madeline, you begin by doing an enormous amount of research and eventually then you throw most of it away.
Yeah.
It has to be a distillation, you know. And what happened here is that I agreed to write this book and because the publisher wasn't offering me very much money up front, we came to an agreement that I would do the book without promising him anything. Mm-hmm. In other words, that he would just trust me to do it.
Yeah.
And I started off with really no idea where it was going to go. I have got a PhD in late 19th century German literature and history, but that was the limit of it. And I found then that if you go back to the basics and read with a kind of open eye and an open mind,
mm-hmm.
and almost literally spread the whole thing, it is over a long time in front of you, with all the research documents you've got and so forth, that if you're lucky, a pattern will emerge. And to my surprise, I found about halfway through, I suddenly realized, my God, there's a really clear pattern here, which I don't think people have really realized before.
Mm-hmm.
Because people tend to specialize. You know this yourself already from your schoolwork, that and as you proceed through university and perhaps do a PhD and so forth, there is a tendency for the system to push people more and more into specialization.
Yeah.
It's part of the whole PhD system. You have to make an original contribution, they say, to work, which means you really have to end up doing something very detailed.
Yeah, and something very niche.
There's a danger that people lose sight of the big picture. Now, obviously, there's a danger on the opposite side. You had to invent a big picture that wasn't there and isn't backed up. But if you're honest about it, then you will find this picture emerging from the actual genuine research.
Yeah, and you mentioned that people tend to specialise, and I guess in the same way for readers or people who just enjoy the history, they tend to enjoy different parts of it. So I was going to mention, because my dad read the book first, when we discussed it and our views of it, we found that we had very differing perspectives on the book, because he, for one, really, really enjoys the ancient history. So he really enjoyed the start of the book, whereas I felt that because I more enjoy the modern history, maybe it's because I can sort of visualize it more, maybe it's because I already know more about it and so I feel like I understand the context more. And so it's interesting, because you cover such an extensive period, that when we came to discuss the book, we had quite differing opinions on it.
Well, obviously, yes. And one of the dangers, of course, is that, and I've just finished writing a similar book about English history, after 3 years of research on it, everyone will find probably that their actual favourite anecdote may not be there.
Yeah.
Because one of the things I do try to do is to avoid the too well-trodden paths there and say something which is a little bit fresh. But I'm delighted that as a family, at least you came, each of you liked some bit of it anyway as a family, so that's good.
Oh yeah, we'll pass it on to Mum and my brother next, and they can share their perspectives on it.
What I'm most pleased about it, obviously, is the fact that it's been quite a substantial bestseller in Germany itself, which has really surprised me. I've actually had a couple of very senior German politicians tell me when the microphones are off that they agree with the thesis, but don't really dare say it out loud.
Well, that's the highest compliment.
No, it is. It's very exciting when that happens, it really is.
Well, you were talking about the fact that you don't want to include the most obvious anecdotes. And I imagine if you've done, you know, 3 years of research, you want to be able to include the most sort of niche, the most newfound things there. And I think that's one of the things that I primarily enjoyed about the book, because as I told you, we've been emailing back and forth. As part of my AS level course, we've studied a lot of Weimar Germany.
Yeah.
And not only do I get to see that period of German history in a wider context when I read the book, but I also got to learn so many more things about Weimar Germany that I wouldn't have learned just from the sort of textbooks that we get as part of the course.
Well, that's fantastic.
I think that's one of my main enjoyments, was reading these things and sort of understanding half of it and then learning completely new things with the other half.
Well, I mean, I myself am very excited. I taught the rise of the Nazi Party at Swansea University back in the 90s. So that was one thing which I had an idea that people didn't quite understand, and I didn't quite understand what was going on there. Mm-hmm. And I'm very glad that you found that enlightening, because I felt that when it came to it, it did ultimately kind of pay off the whole big sweep, the grande durée, as the French call it, of history that I presented here, that suddenly certain vital things, I mean, the $100 question, you know, who actually voted for Hitler, became much, much clearer when you actually look at things on maps, mm-hmm. really. And when you compare those maps to much older maps, you see that if we try to understand the rise of Nazism by talking about an entire country as though it were one thing, that really doesn't work any more than it would work nowadays to talk about Brexit without looking at the boundaries within the United Kingdom. You know, when one becomes aware that Germany is and always has been culturally a very, very split nation.
Yes.
Then you realise that, in fact, really, it was one side of that country that was mainly responsible, decisively responsible for bringing Hitler to power. And that's quite a radical thing to say about any country, of course, because some people, it's really putting the blame on a group of people within it. And to some extent, exculpating the others. And that's a brave thing to do, I suppose. But I think it has to be done, you know.
I was talking about how much I enjoyed the modern history elements of it. And I think that includes a lot of the politics. And prior to reading the book, I had read an article on the AfD, which obviously is becoming more and more prevalent within Germany today. And that's why, you know, usually I don't enjoy looking at maps. I drop geography like 3 years ago, I think, so that's out of my comfort zone. However, when I was reading the book and I got to see maps from different periods and saw that in the context of understanding how people voted and the difference in culture within Germany, I was fascinated, and I don't think I've ever enjoyed looking at maps so much in my life.
Well, I'm delighted. And also, I mean, I'm really, really keen on that reaction of yours, because what I'm very, very passionate about is the idea that if you understand history correctly, it's not just an academic pursuit. To understand the history of one's own country correctly is to be able to understand its politics today and to make the right choices today. And I've been urging my West German friends for a couple of years to not be too worried about the rise of the AfD, because I argue, and it's been borne out by what's happened in Germany in the last 2 years. I started arguing this 3 or 4 years ago, that the AfD does not, and for cultural historical reasons, never will have great penetration in the West. And that's completely been borne out. It reached peak nationally around 14% 2 or 3 years ago. It's never gone beyond that. In the West, it's far lower than in the East. It's never gone beyond about 8 or 9% at any time. Whereas the big story in the West has been the rise of the Greens, which is not paralleled in the East at all. So the split in Germany is a fascinating one. And it does, as these senior German politicians have hinted to me, it potentially even affect their real-world decisions. I argued against it to Merkel's chief of staff on German primetime television that the future of Western Germany is what they would call black-green. In other words, a union between the CDU and the Green Party, on the basis that both these parties have enormous backing in the West. If not in the East, then tough on the East, but they shouldn't be distracted by the AfD. And so I think, hopefully, that history really can, the study of history, if it's truly understood, can actually help us to make really very, very important decisions in the real world right now.
Well, I suppose, yeah, there's two ways of looking at it. If we accept that history in a way repeats itself, or that we should be learning from history, and then in ways that can be quite scary, but in the same means as you were talking, it can be quite comforting, because if we do learn from these things, then we gather that as we move on, that we develop and that we don't make the same mistakes.
It can be comforting, it can also be challenging, in the sense it can make you look at things in the face with reality. And I'm finding that in the book I've just put the finishing touches to, The History of England, I'm quite confident in saying, and I've said this on primetime TV in Germany, the UK is finished. The UK will cease to exist within 10 years, possibly five, because the UK has been in a process of collapse since the dawn of mass voting. And if you look at maps again, the same way as the Germany book, you can see it's really clearly in British history. The UK was a construct of elites. The moment people were given the mass vote by Gladstone in the 1880s, obviously the Irish, but also the Welsh and Scots, immediately began to make nationalist demands.
Yeah.
And that is a process which is not going to stop, as it has been gathering power, gradually held up by two world wars and the enforced unity of that, really, only. But it's a process which is based in history, and it's not going to go away, and it will very, very soon be completed. I mean, Scotland will go, and Wales will follow.
Mm. Well, that's fascinating, and especially to me, because I have a few family members who are very strong supporters of the Yes Cymru movement and the Independence for Wales movement.
And although I'm English from my birth, I absolutely support it. Simply as a historian, it's inevitable. It has to happen.
I was going to ask you, as a next question, I study quite a few languages at A-level. I do English, Welsh and French. I know that you did German.
Yeah.
Do you think it's necessary that you speak and understand a country's language in order to gauge with its history and fully understand the context of that history?
I do, actually, yes. There's a very popular myth among English speakers that everyone speaks English now, so you don't have to learn a foreign language. I think that's utter twaddle. It really is. You know, you cannot understand unless you understand the deeper culture of a country, because cultures last. You see, this is the argument of my book, of all my books, really, is that there is such a thing as a cultural DNA, which is, there's nothing mysterious about it. It's passed on by political attitudes from father to son, mother to children, mm-hmm. and so forth over generations. And these things, they go beyond any surface considerations of politics. So that, you know, the divide between North and South Wales is an obvious one here. And if you don't appreciate the power of language, and if you can't access the original documents and talk to people in the sense of talking to the past in its own tongue, you're going to be in a real problem. And then that's why, for example, I did history at Oxford myself, and then, I don't know whether it's still the case, you know, they absolutely insisted on you having two foreign languages,
mm-hmm.
Because they understood correctly that you really got to be able to look at this, the original documents and the original voices here, to understand what's actually going on, you know.
As someone who speaks Welsh and English and is learning French, I don't know if I'd say I speak it yet, but I really do highly value culture and language. And I was going to say, the other day, I do quite a bit of debating, and the other day I actually judged a friendly debate, if you could call it that, between a few of my friends in practice. And they were debating whether countries should be able to secede unilaterally through a clause in their constitution. And I was shocked to see, because they were Canadian and English teams, quite a few of them making the argument that culture really isn't that important or prevalent anymore, especially in cultures such as Wales and Scotland, and that they, you know, extensions of England. And to me, obviously, you're not supposed to judge with preconceptions of how you view these things. However, I was quite surprised to see so many young people talking about culture, especially Celtic culture, as something that really didn't exist anymore, or something that they couldn't see every day.
It's very simple. Tell them to go move to the Sheen Peninsula without speaking Welsh and see how they get on there.
Make them come to the country and see it for themselves. Yeah. Well, something else I picked up on when I was reading the book was how beautifully it was written, not just as a log of history, but in the creativity of it. And I know that you lecture in creative writing.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And I think that's quite an interesting blend between history and creative writing, because, of course, history is supposed to be fact factual but not just collective memory, whereas creative writing, you have more freedom to express things as you like. So how do you find working the blend between creative writing and writing history?
I actually don't know about that one myself. I actually tend at the moment to think of it more like one of those medieval portrayals of people with angels and devils on different shoulders. I suspect they are quite wide apart areas of the same thing. The one area that which unites them in my case, I found, is the notion of making a story that hangs together. And that is to say that you can't pretend that what you're writing is the complete factual record. It wouldn't matter if the book were 500,000 words long. For example, to take the story in the most famous Welsh history book, Hanes Cymru, it's a story of a place. You can't avoid being a storyteller, and in a sense, the disciplines, the responsibilities, and the artifice you use are the same, really, whether you're trying to tell a fictional story about someone who never lived and the story of a country. You've got to find out what's important to it, what's the centre of it, what's the big drive, what's going on, and what's the conclusion. And I found in one sense that they're quite similar, but there definitely is, to use the banal term, a kind of left brain, right brain thing. I mean, one does feel very much one's using different parts of the brain, because there's that sort of final demand that what you're saying can be backed up, which is not the case in fiction, clearly. But one of the problems with the English language specifically is that, due to the historical bifurcation of English between the Anglo-Saxon and the Norman heritages, specialists in England, academics, tend to write in an extraordinarily Latinate, Frenchified, jargon-like manner, which often obscures what they're saying, in a way which I find really quite irritating. As an academic myself, I'm constantly saying to you, why do you have to say, you know, appropriate spatial units and things like that, or you know, we seem to have English educated Englishmen seem to have this reflex that in order to be respectable, in order to be posh, in order to be accepted and expert, you've got to talk in what's basically French.
Yeah.
It's through the conquest. It's through the conquest, of course, and that means that although I've done a PhD and stuff, I found it myself as a writer so refreshing to have a different way of making points rather than having to fall into this awful professional jargon as though you're some sort of Parisian professor, you know.
Yeah, well, I think that jargon is something that translates actually into, well, my history class. We're often told, you know, we feel that we need to write in posh English in order to sound clever. Yeah. And we focus on that rather than what we're trying to say. And I remember, this is probably when I was a bit younger, but this was, again, history essays, you know, on World War II and the Tudors. I remember my teachers just saying to me, say what you mean. Make sure that it's clear. Clarity is the most important thing. It doesn't matter, you know, don't go on Google or don't go to a thesaurus and find the most posh version of a word you possibly can, because
don't try and do a one woman crusade against it yet before you get to university, because there are large numbers of people at university who do adopt this way of writing. It's nothing, again, there's nothing very profound going on, I'm afraid. It's simply the way in which a guild protects its meal ticket. You know, you have to, if you do a PhD in an arts subject, you have to learn to do this jargon to show you're one of the gang, sadly.
I'll have to play along for a while then.
And I'm afraid I don't see that changing very much in the next 4 or 5 years, so don't you go messing up your own future, being a bold Joan of Arc crusading against that. Let someone else do that, or get in there first and do it.
So you're talking about the final decision, the thesis of your argument with Germany and its history. So presumably you do 3 years of research. Is that how much you said you did on your most recent book?
Yeah, it was about two with the German book and three with the English books. I already knew more about the German history, really.
So about 2 or 3 years of research.
Yeah, yeah.
And then presumably you come to your conclusion and decide on your thesis after that research. And
yes,
then
it grows out of you.
Use that, yeah.
Okay, that's the key to it. And on that basis, you can then start selecting from all your evidence the bits that will best fit that support the thesis. But it's a thesis which didn't impose on the material, but which grew out of it, hopefully. And one hopes that that gives the whole thing a kind of fresh and yet backed up sort of feel, you know.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that you've now moved on to writing a history of England.
Yeah.
Do you think that's something you'll do more of, writing the entire history of countries?
I've just agreed to write the shortest history of Ireland next. So
oh,
yes.
So
and then after that, Russia. So I've got a whole series of them coming up now. I think once you've got the format or the way you want to tell it, the way you want to tell it, which, as you know, in the book includes things like event diagrams and charts and God knows what,
mm-hmm.
a lot of sort of PowerPoint style visual aids, which I find myself a great help, I must say, to me personally. Then you start realizing you can apply these all over the place, and I think the conclusions I've reached about England are as profound as those about Germany. I'll just give you one example for you that might interest you personally and perhaps your listeners here. The notion of England as a united country, for example,
mm-hmm.
we take that as self-evident. Never mind that there are plenty of people in England who think the UK is an eternal construct, which it clearly isn't. England itself. Look at this amazing piece of English history called the Tripartite Indenture. Have you heard of that?
I haven't.
It was fancy. Very few people have, although it forms the basis of one of Shakespeare's most famous plays, Henry IV, Part One. It is the document signed between Owen Glyndwr, the Mortimers and the Percys, which was a formal Latin agreement backed by the King of France to divide England permanently into three areas.
Mm-hmm.
There would be a massively extended Wales, which would encompass the whole of what's now Cheshire, Shropshire, and most of Hereford and Gloucestershire. And the rest of England would be split along the line which has been split along since the Venerable Bede wrote, which is the Trent.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be split between the Percys and the Mortimers forever. Now, that had, you know, had they won a single battle against the young Prince Henry to become Henry V, England might well have been divided in two forever, and a much larger independent Wales might have come to pass. The history is like that. You know, people forget these things. There is nothing inevitable
mm-hmm.
about the UK. There's nothing inevitable about the fact that England is supposed to be a single country. On the contrary, there's much in history that suggests not only that the UK is deeply not inevitable, but that England itself, it really does not work as a united country. So these are where one comes into the lessons of history. Which apply to the most modern political debates, you know. So I'm hoping it can be a sort of help people to guide their way through the eruptions that will come as soon mm-hmm. as the lockdown lets history take its course again, which it will. It won't change anything.
Well, you were talking about how you can apply this to modern history and the way that we vote now. And of course, not only just between, you know, England, Wales and Scotland, but within England itself, we still see a big divide in the way
Absolutely.
That people vote.
We see that divide, and that's why when people who see it win. Cummings, whatever you think of him, was a clever enough man to notice to launch what they called explicitly a Northern strategy in the last election. They did it because they knew that historically, and not just in the age of mass voting, though throughout the age of mass voting, but for far further back than that, the Northern English do not feel any sense of national oneness with the Southern English.
Mm-hmm.
And they put all their effort in the last election into persuading the Northern English for once to vote with the Southern English. That was the key to that winning that election, and they knew it. In the same way as Mandelson knew in 1997 that to win for Labour, you had to have a leader who had what Mandelson called, quote, Southern appeal. So the people who win elections in the UK and particularly in England are the people who've understood history.
Thank you so much for joining me today. I think
pleasure.
I really enjoyed this discussion. I feel like I've learned a lot, and I've enjoyed talking to you about your work. I really look forward to the history of England and the history of Ireland and the history of Russia as they come out in their turn, and I'll definitely
if God
be reading
spares
them.
Me.
Thank you very much for joining me today. I appreciate it, and I appreciate you taking time out of your day to have this FaceTime call so we can record an episode.
Great pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you, James Hawes, for joining me on the first ever English language podcast episode of the podcast. Next week, it'll be back to Welsh as I talk to two representatives of the Welsh Youth Parliament, Betsan and Lleici. But perhaps in the future, we'll have a few more English language episodes. On that note, thank you to everyone who listens. It's one of my favourite parts, looking at who's listening and from where. We've got some people from all over the world, ranging from the UK, obviously, and a lot from Wales, to Slovakia, Canada, Ukraine, America, Australia, and more. So thank you to everyone, and I hope you enjoy, and I hope you keep on listening.